When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's LizaOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers, Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teamsters Local 695, and Madison Teachers Incorporated. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation with us. Brother Nichols, how are you?
I am okay.
Well, let's cut right to the chase and go with the story that's so amazing that it's hard for me to even fathom that this could happen in the United States of America. When we, you know, when your parents would tuck you in bed there down in Union Grove and they were telling you about democracy and
they did.
Yeah, right. You were stopping at all those historical markers. Remember that?
Absolutely.
You were learning. Didn't you have a relative that was Secretary of State or something?
State Treasurer. It wasn't necessarily the most honorable one in the history.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever. You probably never thought this would happen. Here we go. This is from ABC.
Even before Hurricane Florence hit shore, President Trump is already congratulating his team on a job well done.
We're getting tremendous accolades from politicians and the people.
But even as the hurricane approaches, the president today is making a startling new claim, downplaying the human suffering caused by last year's Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico, he tweeted. He then falsely accused Democrats of inflating the death toll in order to make me look as bad as possible. A comprehensive study from George Washington University concluded nearly 3,000 people died by causes directly related to the hurricane and its aftermath, a figure accepted by the government as the official death toll. That's nearly 3,000 American citizens, most of them poor and elderly. Our team saw the suffering firsthand. Maria Ortiz caring for 11 seniors in a nursing home without power.
We can't let them die. We can't let them die. And we need help, all the help we can get, please.
When President Trump visited the island, he tossed paper towels to storm victims. But just 15 minutes away in this apartment building without power or clean water,
Buenas tardes.
David spoke with 70-year-old Maria Diaz. We don't want to die here, she told him. The governor of Puerto Rico today is taking issue with the president's tweets.
Las víctimas de Puerto Rico.
The people of Puerto Rico, he said, do not deserve to have their pain questioned. And among political leaders, the president seems to be alone in questioning the death toll.
I have no reason to dispute these numbers.
With 3,000 people dead, for the president to say that Puerto Rico was a success, a triumph of his presidency, is simply delusional.
Well, there you go. It's kind of beyond delusional, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think the term delusional is sort of generous. You know, it's political. I mean, that's the bottom line. He knows full well, you know, give Trump credit for this. He knows full well that one of the things that contributed tremendously to the decline of George W. Bush's administration during its second term and to the defeat of Republicans aligned with Bush was the mishandling of the aftermath of Katrina down in New Orleans and on the Gulf Coast. And there, too, was a situation where you had folks who were often low-income, often dispossessed folks, who suffered horribly because their government just did not kick in effectively, didn't seem to care. And that, I think, led an awful lot of Americans to say, you know, look, this is the basics of what a government ought to do. This is how it ought to work. So I think Trump knows that. And I think he is doing what George W. Bush was too honorable to do, and Bush certainly didn't handle things perfectly and even didn't handle the public discussions of things perfectly, obviously. But, you know, Trump is simply denying. He's denying reality in hopes that it will, you know, muddy the waters, that it will confuse discussions about the failures of his administration on some really fundamental things. And the final thing I'll say about it is that I think that the neglect of Puerto Rico is a particularly horrific story, because Trump has attempted to suggest that neglect was due to logistical challenges, right? Because at one side he's saying what a great job they did, and the other side he's saying, oh, well, you know, it's an island, right? And the same was true with many of the other Republicans. You know, Puerto Rico is a plane trip from the U.S. It is a place that the U.S., that is a part of the U.S. These are citizens of the United States. And from the start of this thing, Donald Trump has set a signal that somehow Puerto Rico is a lesser part of the U.S.
Well, for God's sake, you don't need to take your passport.
No, well, and also Puerto Ricans, you know, have served in our wars, have contributed mightily to this country on all sorts of levels.
I heard some Republican operative say yesterday, well, we understand that Puerto Rico wants statehood. You know, maybe if enough Puerto Ricans in Florida vote for Rick Scott, we can have a bipartisan effort.
Oh, there you go.
What a craven, horrible thing to say.
Well, in the discussion of
a tragedy like this.
I know. Look, here's the bottom line, though. It is appropriate to discuss statehood issues and empowerment issues because, you know, look, at the heart of the matter here, I mean, this is a core thing to understand about Puerto Rico. It does not have voting representation in the House or the Senate. If it had voting representation in the House and the Senate, either via statehood or via, you know, some sort of acceptance that, you know, no U.S. citizens can go unrepresented, and so, you know, you give representation rights to commonwealths and to other possessions of the United States, however you want to go through this. But if there were two senators from Puerto Rico, if there were, I don't know, is it four or five, maybe six members of Congress from Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, do you think that they would have been neglected?
No.
In the same way? Of course not.
No.
So these
well,
are
of course, what are the license plates on all the federal vehicles, you know, that are in Donald Trump's motorcade? They say, you know, Washington, D.C., taxation without representation. So we don't need to look too further than the confines of the District of Columbia.
We have millions of Americans, most of them people of color, American citizens who are not represented because they live in D.C., they live in Puerto Rico. They live in the Virgin Islands. They live in possessions in the Pacific. You know, this is, it's absolutely untenable in the 21st century. And so there's a lot that's wrong here. At the core of what's wrong is the fact that Donald Trump, for reasons of politics, is continuing to play games with and to lie about a circumstance in which thousands of Americans died and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, suffered horribly.
Let me ask you, his numbers are terrible right now, and there's been a real consistent pattern over 5-6 polls of him dropping well into the mid-30s, in some cases low 30s. How do you think that's going to make a difference in places like West Virginia and Indiana and Missouri and Montana and North Dakota?
It does make a difference. It makes a difference on two levels, and each of them, you know, we should be conscious of. The first level is that there's a real problem, right? So you have a mobilization issue that tends to favor Democrats. I think Democrats are angry with Trump. They don't like him. Same with a lot of independents, and there's rising energy there. And so those folks are going to turn out. At the same time, just as importantly, one of the places where the disenchantment with Trump, as his numbers go down, even among relatively more centrist and conservative voters is the prospect that a lot of people just don't show up. And, you know, that's what decides elections. There are swing voters, but there aren't many of them. The key is, do voters who are enthusiastic for the president's party show up, give that party victories, give that president victories, or do voters who are motivated to send a signal show up? And that's true, you know, not just in, you know, Democratic-leaning states. It's not just true in swing states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, where you could see some really big Democratic gains. But it's also true in states that, you know, are quite friendly to the president, because in those states, it's obviously going to be hard for Democratic senators, particularly, to get reelected. But, you know, these Democratic senators who are running, by the way, you know, in a play out of the 2012 cycle where Barack Obama brought a lot of people to the polls, and Democrats had, you know, stronger turnouts in places that ultimately, a couple years later, 4 years later, voted for Trump. These senators really need a boost, right? It's going to be hard in a midterm election for them in, you know, a state like Montana. But if Democrats are energized, Republicans aren't showing up, and independents, key thing here, and independents really are conscious of a need to check and balance the president. They may not even be all that liberal, but they just think, you know, wow, you know, you got to push back on this thing. That's almost a perfect storm for a guy like John Tester, the senator from Montana, who is a relatively progressive Democrat representing a state that voted overwhelmingly for Trump.
With all this, we have Bob Woodward's book, which is kind of interesting, coming out during this time period. And it's as Lisa Douglas would say from Green Acres, it's selling like hotcakes.
Yeah, a million copies.
Right.
As somebody writes books, I can tell you, that's good.
Well, it's interesting because Bob Woodward is, you know, he's a reporter and obviously has a lot of credibility. But he's also somebody with an opinion, and he's kind of offering his opinion during his TV appearances and the way this is written. Let me play a couple clips here. I'll play them back to back, and then you can comment.
One is different and unique. There are some similarities. There's some differences. I think the key in examining Trump is actually, what will he do when people present him with facts? For instance, it sounds a little esoteric, but the World Trade Organization, which the United States is a member of, very important, allows us to file complaints of unfair trade practices. And there's a meeting in the Oval Office, and the president says, well, the World Trade Organization is the worst organization ever. We lose all our cases. And they present data.
No.
Pardon?
Showing, I said, no, we actually win most of our cases there.
Yeah. Like 85.7% of them. Not just 85%, but 85.7%. And he says, no, that's not true. And the people there say, look, call the U.S. Trade Representative, your guy, and you will confirm this. I don't want to hear. I don't want to call him. I don't want to deal with it. And at some point, that these trade deficits are bad for the economy. Actually, the trade deficits with specific countries are good for the economy because Americans are buying things that have lower prices, better quality, and that money is not taken from us. Quite the opposite. But somehow he's got in his head the idea that we lose this money. Americans lose this money, and 99.9% of the economists radically disagree from both parties, all kinds of economists, except for two people who are in Trump's orbit, Peter Navarro, who's the special assistant in the White House, and Wilbur Ross, who's the Secretary of Commerce. They agree with the president. Looking through this, I found no one else who does, and empirically, it makes no sense.
I'm going to have you respond. We're up against a break here, but I'll have you respond to that. Those were two long clips, but I wanted you to hear all of them.
Cannot wait to respond.
All right. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. It's LiesOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
You have a broken guitar? Don't fret. Take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson to Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We'll have you fretting your guitar in no time at all. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, we love guitars.
Welcome back to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works, also our friends at the Axley Law Firm and SNR Remodeling. All right, so interesting enough, I play those clips about Bob Woodward talking about the World Trade Organization and that he looked high and low and he couldn't find anyone that believed trade deficits were bad for America. Yeah. Your response?
He needs to get out more. You know, I mean, you know that it's said, and I hope I'm not misstating this, that you know, Woodward conducts at least some of the interviews for his books or does some of the research at his house. And that
I bet it's a nice house.
I bet it's a very nice house. And more power to him. He's done some good work along the way. But that sounded like the statement of somebody who doesn't get out of their house very much. Because the notion that the World Trade Organization is somehow a big benefit for America, that involvement in the World Trade Organization is somehow a big benefit for America, only works if you think that America is defined by stock prices and company profits, the profits of multinational corporations. Because when Bob Woodward says that, you know, the United States wins most of the time, overwhelmingly, 85% of the time in the World Trade Organization, is he talking about workers in Janesville, right, who used to work at the truck plant? Is he talking about workers in Eau Claire, who used to work in tire plants? Is he talking about workers in Kenosha, who used to make engines at an engine plant there? Or is he talking about investors in multinational corporations that are not loyal to the United States, per se, happen to be headquartered in the United States, but that have long histories of moving their operations around in order to race to the bottom on wages, on environmental protections, on democracy issues. And when the WTO intervenes on wages, environmental issues, democracy issues, it intervenes on behalf of corporations that object, right? It intervenes on behalf of, you know, in some cases, government being on the side of those corporations. But it doesn't intervene on behalf of the laid-off worker. It doesn't intervene on behalf of the
polluted stream. The notion, though, that he couldn't find anyone, that there's trade deficits are bad.
Don't even have to leave Washington to find Lori Wallach.
Or Scott Paul from the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Or Sherrod Brown.
Or Sherrod Brown. Or, you know, Jeff Merkley.
Yeah, it's an important thing to understand. when he talks about, you know, economists of all parties.
Well, that's a party of one.
There's progressive economists, many of them, who you could easily find in D.C., who raise big issues about this. Have been, you know, literally, people know what's wrong with the WTO, with these trade deals, from progressive economists.
Well, and let me add one more note, because the steelworkers sponsor this this podcast. Leo Gerard, their president, often says, even when we win cases, when we take them to the WTO, that in fact, by the time they rule in our favor, it's too late, the jobs are gone.
Well, exactly. And again, it's the issue at the heart of this is, why does the WTO exist? Why do most of these trade deals exist? Why are they in place? They are not in place to help workers, to protect the environment, to promote democracy. They are in place to help multinational corporations see off and overcome demands from workers, regulations,
right, exactly,
structural protections for the people.
Well, let me play one more thing regarding this. The other day, Chris Hayes, who used to be kind of on our side on these issues, we don't hear him speak about them anymore, so I don't know if he's changed his mind or not, but MSNBC went to Flint, and they brought on some voters who didn't vote in the 2016 general election in Michigan. This is a college student from Lansing.
There's other reasons as well. I mean, if I'm being frank, the candidate wasn't inspiring to me. I'd seen the devastation that like the any blue will do kind of mentality will have. I mean, I've grown up in this city, and I've seen as trade deals decimated this city, every job. And frankly, those policies were implemented by Bill Clinton, and they weren't repudiated by Hillary Clinton as they should have been.
There are people who are watching this right now who are, like, throwing things at the television.
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm just saying, like, I want you to respond to it, because they are shaking the screen being like, not inspiring enough. Like, this is not a performance for you.
You know, and the thing is like, I think that mentality goes really well if you in your life right now, you're doing great, and like, to you the election doesn't matter, but to me, like, it's not enough to say that you're not as bad as the other guy. I need real change, and for me, Democrats hadn't offered that, and they weren't offering.
That was really something, wasn't it?
Very well said. Look, I don't happen to agree with that young man. I actually believe that there was enough of a difference, an inspiring enough difference, perhaps, you know, generated as much by or more by Trump than by Clinton, to go vote, right? So I disagree with his choice, right, if he didn't vote. But his analysis ought not be questioned.
Well, and
right?
For the cookie cutter Democrats that watch MSNBC and don't care about the economics of the upper Midwest or anywhere, for the most part, they just don't pay attention to economic issues. You know, their ignorance there are so many Democrats that are so ignorant on economic issues and why we have this unstable political system that we have. It's so frustrating, John.
Oh, I know. Look, brother, I've been dealing with it for a very long time. And I was blessed to be born in southeastern Wisconsin, in Racine, near Kenosha, raised in the farm country where people either went to work on a family farm or went to work in a factory in Racine or Kenosha or that region around there. And as a result, I grew up understanding more about global economics than folks who didn't have that
right
lucky break of birth. And I don't say that makes me a genius. I don't even say it makes me all that sharp. But the bottom line is, I know what bad trade policies and what compromises by the Democratic Party that is supposed to represent workers, supposed to be for protecting the environment, supposed to be for defending democracy, not just domestically but on the global stage. I know what bad trade deals and compromises by the Democratic Party did and continue to do
right.
to places across this country.
All right. We have a couple minutes left. I want you to react to two ads that are running right now. One is a Walker ad, the other is a Baldwin ad.
As superintendent, Tony Evers failed to remove abusive teachers from our schools. Now, Evers wants to cut Wisconsin's prison population in half. A dangerous plan that today would mean releasing thousands of violent criminals back into our communities, which could include felons who've committed rape, assault, robbery, and even kidnapping. First, abusive teachers, now releasing violent criminals, putting everyone at risk. We just can't trust Tony Evers to keep us safe.
And here's the Baldwin ad.
I'm Tammy Baldwin, and I approve this message.
Who really is Leah Vukmir? For 16 years, Vukmir served in the state legislature and been a national leader of ALEC, an organization funded by corporations to lobby state governments. Vukmir's repeatedly supported new tax breaks for the wealthy, fought to weaken safety standards at nursing homes, and tried to end senior care, which provides low-cost prescription drugs to seniors. Leah Vukmir, she's not for us.
Good morning.
I know someone who lives on the Near East Side, a woman that grew up in Philadelphia that will just love that ad.
How come? yeah, I will tell you that focusing in on ALEC and on the secretive organization funded by the Koch brothers and corporations, you know, really intersecting with much of the conversation we've had about trade policy and a host of other things because, you know, this is where all these things sort of come together. That's getting politics to where it needs to be. I really like where the Baldwin ad went. But I assume you played those two ads together because we're going to analyze the use of scary music. You know, it's a very interesting thing that if you step back and say, well, these are both negative ads. They're both ads that attack or criticize the opponent, and they even use all the techniques of modern politics, the scary music, the shaded photos, you know, bit. But at the heart of them, you see two different, very different things going on here. One of these, the Baldwin ad, is seeking to tell voters about, you know, sort of a really dangerous side of our politics, a dark side of our politics that happens usually beyond scrutiny, beyond the attention of even a lot of our media. It's an important message. On the other hand, what you see with the Walker ad is pure scare tactics, right? Something, nothing new about this. This isn't, you know, trying to, you know, open things up to tell people more, to inform voters more. This is a return to the sort of ads that we have seen, you know, really going back almost 50 years.
Yeah, well, I use the example of when Bob Caston knew he was going to probably lose. He threw everything but the kitchen sink at Russ Feingold and accused him of, you know, supporting legislation that would have let Jeffrey Dahmer out.
Yeah, which I just don't think that was what, you know, Russ Feingold was about. And, you know, but here's an interesting thing. I think that this is another example. We'll see where it ends up. But I think this is another example of how Scott Walker, who's always been on his game and often a little ahead of the curve, right, in part because of his, you know, his fascination with politics, his deep engagement with it.
Or cravenness.
Yeah. Well, this year he's off his mark, right? Because you know what you know where I was yesterday afternoon? I was with Tommy Thompson at one of Tommy's book events. And you know what Tommy Thompson was talking about?
Yeah, he was talking about prison reform and how he's built too many prisons.
He built too many prisons, literally saying he wants to close a prison, saying that he wants to assess prisoners, figure out what their needs are, get them the drug and alcohol care they need, get them the education and job training they need, try to look for ways to reduce the number of people coming into prison, to address recidivism, to, you know, I mean, and basically literally saying he wants to show more compassion with regard to people who are in prison and with regard to the criminal justice system. Now, I will tell you, if Scott Walker was running against Tommy Thompson, he would be putting the same kind of ad up, right? He'd be saying he wants to close our prisons, wants to be compassionate to prisoners. Well, you know what? Tommy Thompson is no softy. He's no lefty. Tommy Thompson recognizes that we have moved forward over the last 20 or 30 years. We've recognized things. We've learned things. We've figured some stuff out. And building out prisons, you know, just, you know, looking for the simplistic tough on crime message hasn't worked. It's not the answer. And so Walker's advocating for something very old, something that's not very functional. And my bet is, I don't know this for sure, certainly not, but my bet is that at some point in very short order, we're going to see an ad quoting Tommy Thompson in which Scott Walker's taken apart. Now, Tommy Thompson's not going to back Tony Evers, I promise you that, like a lot of Walker aides are. But I do think that that you're going to see Republican and conservative statements about the need for criminal justice reform, as well as a look at the disaster of the Department of Corrections under Scott Walker, turned right back at him. If he wants to open this issue up, my sense is that he doesn't win on it.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.